Mayors talk consolidation at JU after 50 years. Do we know if it's working? A new regional rebrand proposed, ready to beat a Waterlife region? Downtown Vision is 2020 plans for Berkman, a new convention center, and a familiar face as DIA CEO. Meanwhile, Jacksonville's CFO heads out the door. Meanwhile, a divorce between President Trump and Ron DeSantis shakes up the governor's race. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and thanks for listening. I'm A.G. Gankarski, in again for Melissa Ross. We are live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect this Friday. Just ahead, we'll hear about a busy week in the news with our media roundtable, 549-2937 for your calls. Then later, a blanket party. We're talking quilting at the Prime Osborne this weekend. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome Florida Times Union writer David Bauerlein. David, hello.
Good morning, AG.
WJCT contributor Fred Matthews. Fred?
Good morning, AG.
Daily Record reporter Dangerous Dave Cotton.
Oh, hey.
And Folio Weekly editor, the best they've had, Claire Goforth. Claire, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing, AG?
Great. So let's jump in. We got a busy week. The first thing, Consolidation Revisited. Jacksonville University hosted six mayors. Current Mayor Lenny Curry, Alvin Brown, John Payton, John Delaney, Tommy Azuri, and Jake Godbold Wednesday. And the topic was big. Consolidation 50 years prior. Consolidation brought an efficiency of services, but some say it came with a price. African Americans divested of political power, and promises broken regarding extending the same quality of city services to those older neighborhoods that new construction developments enjoy. But that said, the mayors generally offered endorsements of Jacksonville's radical experiment in government, even as Godbold and Brown spotlighted flaws in the bargain. Godbold noted that there were two separate city councils at one point, with one running the city and the other restructuring local government. Delaney noted that the mayors in early decades remedied the city's inferiority complex, but at the expense of neighborhoods like Mandarin, which would have had their own governments. Delaney also said that white flight decimated downtown. Brown also said that some people felt left behind by consolidation with the money quote of the evening. Consolidation really took the opportunity away to have a black mayor in black city, bottom line. There are parts of our community, older communities looking for septic and sewers. You'll be able to see the full program on WJXT4 this week in Jacksonville. Questions of callers and panelists. 50 years after consolidation, is it working? Or have the promises been broken to such a degree that the model can be deemed a fraud? Fred, I want to start with you. Consolidation 50 years in. How's that affecting the core city?
Well, I mean, we can see the results. There is an argument that can be made that the tax base that comes from around the entire county has helped to make the core city survive. So that the financial argument, I think, is for the city as a whole is pretty solid. The political argument is what continues to stew in some quarters because, like many of my friends and relations and classmates, they all left Jacksonville and went to Atlanta because they could get better jobs, they could get better paying jobs, and they could get better respect for where they were living at. And we can see how well Atlanta has done under when they chose. At the same time, Jacksonville was making their decision, Atlanta was making their political decision also. And we can see the difference in what has taken place there for African Americans politically and economically. But from the other side of the fence, from majority white mayors that we have here, of course, it's great for them. It's all worked out well. What we've also seen is that you cannot get elected if you're an African American unless you have an R behind your name on an at large basis. We still haven't elected but what, two African Americans on an at-large basis. They have to have that R behind their name. Otherwise, they're not going to get elected on an at-large basis here. Alvin Brown was fortunate to get elected as mayor, but only through a quirk, as we all have noted around this table, a quirk of the election process that particular year. The Republican candidates were battling it out and forgot, oh, we could let this guy get elected, but he only got one term.
Dave Bauerlein, I want to go with you. Alvin Brown, obviously you covered his mayoralty, you covered his campaigns. He talked about the broken promises of consolidation. In his 4 years in office, what did he do to remedy those promises, and did this performance affect his reelection bid?
Yeah, there was not much money to be spent during Alvin Brown's 4 years. So, no, there was not a huge, massive effort to remedy those problems. There were some water lines that were put into places that did not have them, but very incremental. And that's the big the big potential of a consolidated city-county government is that you can marshal a huge number of resources and push it into an area or an agenda and really see results. During Alvin Brown's term, the city was just struggling to basically avoid cuts in service. There was no ability financially to correct the make good on promises from consolidation.
Dave Cotton, Claire, I'm going to bring you in on this. Dave, I mean, you've been covering the City Hall budget process. There's a lot more money because of pension reform. Where is that money going? Is it going to the core city? Is it going to JSO? Tell us about the process.
Well, we see again this year JSO getting a bump. I think it's, what, $31 million in their budget this year. I mean, the mayor kind of has a couple of different little projects in the capital improvement budget, namely this, you know, $10 million over the next 5 years for, you know, to clean up cemeteries and, you know, predominantly African-American communities, some of these historic cemeteries. The mayor has been doing these neighborhood walks recently where, you know, we're going to clean up these neighborhoods and we're really committed. But really what you see, even with the savings from the pension, what you're seeing is more of a focus on downtown projects, these road diets that we see in some parts of some neighborhoods around downtown, but also more money for things like public works, JSO again, JFRD can't build fire stations fast enough. They're under a lot of strain right now. So you're seeing that money go in there. There's still, if you ask, I think, the district council members in the northwest part of Jacksonville, they still tell you it's not enough. There needs to be more focus on septic tank removal, just building infrastructure in general. I mean, it's almost the tale of two cities right now, still 50 years after consolidation. We mentioned, at-large council members. One of the things that Jake Godbold has said repeatedly is that there needs to be more at-large council members, that the district council members are too parochial. But, you know, I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
Yeah, this was actually a talking point during the discussion with, do we need more at-large council people? Some mayors were saying that. Some mayors are saying we don't need any. I think Alvin Brown was saying they should all be district. You know, Claire, when you look at, you know, Mayor Curry's budgets and the One City, One Jacksonville promise, you know, how close is he to fulfilling that? I mean, he's halfway through. He may or may not be reelected, but, you know, we have enough to sort of judge. I mean, the cemetery appropriation is something that was a lightning rod for somebody like Garrett Dennis. You know, where do you see the state of the political landscape?
Well, you really can't expect Lenny Curry to fix Jacksonville in 2.5 years. I mean, politicians go around, they make these promises, and I mean, we all know that it's basically pie in the sky political talking points, and that's what they do. They want to get elected. They want to say these things that people want to hear. I think that in Jacksonville, you're seeing what we have 50 years of promises made and promises broken, promises made and promises broken, where year after year, when it comes time for the election, they start making promises. We're going to phase out your septic tanks. We're going to fix your streets. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Election passes. Well, we don't have the money now. And then we have, at the same time, we're spending more and more on policing, which really disproportionately affects Black communities and has disenfranchised the Black residents of Jacksonville and the residents of the United States of America for too long. And I mean, we're just seeing a reflection of these national issues on the local level.
A provocative viewpoint. I mean, are people being disenfranchised by consolidation? 549-2937. We want your calls. We've got a caller right now online. Stanley from downtown, you're on the air. Stanley, please talk when ready.
Yes, good morning to everyone. Yes, I'm in agreement with most of everything you said here. But my point, when you look at 50 years of consolidation, you have to deal with race here, because anybody in their right mind who is concerned about the whole city will make sure that the north side is taken care of too, especially when it comes to underserved communities over there. And I want to definitely say that there's a lot of underserved communities, but there's a lot of great communities on the north side. And I don't see too many people reflecting that when they talk about the north side. But my main point here, with you having 50-some years of consolidation, 50 years of consolidation, the leadership hasn't been equal to everyone in the city. And that's with every one of the mayors, all of them. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Stanley. So, you know, let's take that that call into, you know, perspective here. When we look at consolidation, we talk about the north side, Northwest Jacksonville coming up short. But, you know, are there other areas of town? If we look at Arlington, if we look at the south side, we look at deep west side, do they have some of the same issues? Or is this just a Northwest, North Jacksonville problem? Dave Browning.
Well, it's not just a Northwest Jacksonville issue. I mean, obviously, some of the first ring of suburbs around downtown nationally, in a case in Jacksonville, too, are suffering from time, age, aging infrastructure, et cetera. Arlington, obviously, was the big pioneering suburb. Now it's feeling a lot of that strain in terms of the social ills. So it's not just Northwest Jacksonville. But I think a lot of the point is that Jacksonville has some of the wealthiest, most affluent, well-educated zip codes in the state. It's also got some of the poorest, most distressed, crime-ridden zip codes in the state. That has been the case for decades, and consolidation has not solved that. The argument seems to be, well, it would be even worse if not for consolidation, which is really impossible to say one way or the other, I don't think. But there, it is something where the inner ring of suburbs is starting to feel some of that same pressure that Northwest Jacksonville has had for a long time.
Well, and I think when you talk about, you know, we talk about the difference in suburbs, right? The TU just had a story a week or so ago about how the 32204 suburb is like, you know, the magnet for millennials, right? And then you look at 32209, or you look at a zip code neighboring that has dealing with, you know, crime and just, you know, a lot of bad violence. Jacksonville is one of those places where you cross the street and, you know, all of a sudden it's like you're in a different place, you know, considering the Five Points area, the King Street area, and then you go a little bit further, deeper west side, and it's, you know, kind of not a spot you want to go out and hang out with your friends.
Exactly.
You know.
You know, and this is something we're going to keep coming back to. Obviously, consolidation issues isn't going away. We have a parallel topic, a new strategic plan from Jacks USA. It recommends embracing Jacksonville as the region's name and using the Water Life Center of America as the brand essence. The Daily Record reported that the seven-county region should be rebranded and needs to work together to make it the highest-performing economy in the nation, according to a strategic plan called Elevate Northeast Florida. You know, the idea is that the shared regional brand is recognized and magnified when local organizations agree to lead with it. So Jacksonville would be the region, sort of like Charlotte, USA, Greater Austin, Greater Columbus, Metro Denver. And the Water Life Center of America proposal is something that would be a regional proposal. We want to get your calls on this, 549-2937. We've seen a lot of branding, Where Florida Begins. We saw that here, the bold new city of the South. This is the new regional branding. And I want to get the panelists in on this, too. Water Life Center of America, is this going to stick? Claire Goforth.
So catchy. No, it's not. I think that it's going to be very difficult to make this case to cities like St. Augustine and Fernandina Beach that have existing branding. They are very recognized nationally. My mother travels a lot through work, and she's always running into people who have been to our friend's restaurant in Fernandina Beach. These people do not associate Amelia Island with Jacksonville. It's sort of like the distant hinterland from there. If we brand it as the Water Life Mecca or whatever it is that going to bring more people to Jacksonville? Is that going to give us a more cohesive identity? It's doubtful.
Well, it is easier here.
I mean, and how many hours did they spend on that idea? 1,500 hours or something?
And look, I get the wanting to brand regionally. I think a lot of big cities do this. Greater Jacksonville, I can understand, I guess. But this just, you know, it's funny. We were looking through all the social media, you know, comments through our Facebook page, and it was like, no, stop. This isn't going to work.
So we're not going to be bold anymore, huh?
I don't know. We've got a caller who might be bold. We've got a caller on hold here who may or may not be bold. A familiar face. John calling from the Fuller-Warren Bridge. John, welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. I went over the Fuller-Warren Bridge, and I was so desperately looking just to see one boat on the river, but I didn't. So, but anyway, getting back to the water.
Need some kayak thing, launches.
Well, you know, even that's not easier here. But
what do you think of Water Life Center of America?
Listen, on Monday, we're bringing Drippy back. You know, at the Environmental Protection Board meeting Monday, you know, it's in committee. But if you go back to 2005, 1414 was the legislation, you know, You know, that was, you know, again, this waterway activation stuff. You know, I kind of agree with your previous caller. Unless you open up the river, you tell people, come on down. I mean, we're doing a lot of swimming in the river. But let's just see some, like you said, activity on the waterways.
Right on. Thank you, sir.
We have a lot to go with that. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir, John. Thank you.
But again, of all the proposals we have, all of them are right there on the two major ones, the ShotCon proposal, and now this latest one with Berkman we'll talk about. All of those, and of course, across the river that Pete Rummel has put together, all of those are right there on the river. My concern for that is that with the previous projections, that what the river is going to take over at least a third of downtown within the next, 15 years or so, that's going to be underwater. What preparations are being made for this bold plan here? If we're going to have certainly we can be a water life center, but it looks like part of downtown and part of the south side is going to be underwater.
I mean, an aquatic hotel is bold.
Yeah.
Well, everybody says we need an aquarium. So.
Yeah, underwater aquarium would be nice, I guess, if that's where we're going, because the projections are just that they're going to be underwater. What preparations are we making about this? Or are these developments just ignoring this fact?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good point that you're bringing up here. If we look at the water activation stuff that's being done downtown versus flood mitigation, when you look at the budgeting of Dave Bauerlein, you know, are you seeing attention to flood mitigation? Are you seeing attention to solving the issues that, you know, we saw in Irma or anything like that? Or are we just seeing more branding initiatives right now?
Well, in terms of the problems in Irma, I mean, that was a huge, big problem. No, there's nothing that's been done, I don't think, to solve the problems that happened in Irma. And that would be requiring construction, I think, of huge, huge ponds where water would be able to run off and collect until the river goes down. You're talking about huge amounts of land, huge amounts of construction. So, no, there's nothing like that happening. If I can just pick up, because I may be the contrary one here. I like the idea of the water life theme. I had some relatives visit a few weeks ago. They got a beach house in Fernandina Beach. And the first thing they said when they got off the plane was, wow, there's really a lot of water in this area. That's what they saw looking out the window. You got the St. John's River.
I think
River.
You got a slogan there.
You got the ocean. Yeah. Wow.
That's a lot of
water. But
here.
You got the ocean. You have the St. John's River. You got the creeks. You got the tributaries. Now, a lot of other Florida counties and regions have water, too. So a lot of it is, okay, how do you make sure that there's something to do on the water so it's not just a natural resource? But I think it does tie all the areas around. St. Augustine's got water. It's on that's how St. Augustine was founded, was people sailing into a harbor and creating St. Augustine. I think it could really work as a way to make this region stand out. I don't know what other thing really connects the region that could be a big brand identity other than the water.
Yeah, I mean, these are some interesting points, because we saw this week a lot of development in terms of downtown projects that may be moving forward. We're going to talk about some of those projects. One such, the redevelopment proposed of the Berkman 2 site on the North Bank, expected to be a $122 million effort with the city paying $36 million. The term sheet says the developer is proposing a 340-room hotel, a family entertainment center, you're out of luck if you're single, a water park, and a parking garage for the site. 200 public short-term parking spaces being that parking garage. The family entertainment center would have arcade games, indoor attractions like a ropes course and rock wall, an outdoor amusement rides along the St. John's, and a 200-foot observation wheel, do not call it a Ferris wheel, with enclosed acclimated gondolas and a Wi-Fi. You know, so this family entertainment center hotel concept, Dave Cotton, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, that $122 million number is interesting, because during their presentation, so on Wednesday, the DIA, you know, invited this group in to vote on whether or not they should move forward with incentives and send this to the city council. But, you know, they said that, you know, $122 million is probably the cheapest we'll go.
Oh.
you know, it's more likely to be $150 million. But there were some questions as far as, you know, where does that construction cost go into? I mean, are they going to spend $10 million on a Ferris wheel or an observatory, whatever they called it? So there were some questions there. But really, you know, it's taking this Berkman 2 structure that's been idle for a decade, repurposing it into a hotel. They're in talks with the folks who are bringing the USS Adams to Jacksonville. That would be parked there. But I think there's a lot of questions. I know me and David were sitting there
afterwards.
Isn't there
a lawsuit involved?
There is a lawsuit involved. In fact, we wrote about that this morning. And just to be quick about it, there's a group that was supposed to develop this property last year. They are suing, alleging that the new property owners kind of edged them out and owe them money for all of the work that they did previously. That complicates things because these guys told the DIA board on Wednesday that they could likely break ground or begin some sort of construction in December.
Now, pardon me if I'm wrong, you guys have been covering it much more than I have, but isn't there also a bit of corporate welfare involved here to the tune of $36 million that we're asking the taxpayers for to give these guys a break on their tax for how long? 20 years?
Yeah, let's break that down. $20 million in REV grant property tax forgiveness over 20 years. That might now max out. An $8.25 million operation performance subsidy, a $3.25 million grant for competing redevelopment, $4.5 million more for the parking garage. Dave Barrowland, help me out. What's an operation performance subsidy?
So it's basically something that's brand new. I don't know that it's ever been done before in Jacksonville, but basically the taxpayers would help to subsidize the operation of this hotel. And they would basically say that whatever your revenue was last year, we're going to pay 5% of that amount so that you can help to subsidize your continued operation of the hotel.
Well, we should all get a tax break for driving to work every day instead of having to pay that fee we pay on our car because we contribute to the economy. And if we couldn't make it to work, the economy couldn't work. I mean, this is what folks are talking about. This is the height of corporate welfare. If you're going to build it, if you've got the money to build it, if you're going to get the financing to build it, why should you come to the taxpayers comes the question. To help you subsidize your fantasy, which in 20 years could be the landing.
Claire, you're shaking your head there. Why don't you jump in?
I mean, Fred's absolutely right. You know, we look at these big time projects coming to downtown and all of the money that they're taking from we the people. I mean, just a few minutes ago, we're talking about the promises of consolidation and how neighborhoods have been left behind. You know, when you're like in my neighborhood, you're walking down crumbling streets and you're looking at flooding when we just have a regular rainstorm. There's blight. There's crime. And meanwhile, some big time company is getting $36 million plus 5% of their operating cost. You know, it's really easy to get a bitter taste in your mouth when you see these kind of decisions again and again where we're handing corporate welfare to fat cats. Meanwhile, you and I are just, you know, sucking it up on the south side.
Okay, let's talk about the convention center, too. That's another proposal. Dave Cotton, tell us about this convention center and where it's at in the pipeline.
Well, so on Wednesday, again, at the DIA meeting, Andre Wallace, the outgoing CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority, revealed, you know, the scores for these companies who bid to build this down there at the old courthouse and the old City Hall Annex. Surprisingly enough, Shad Khan's partners, Rimrock Devlin, who also want to build one next door to us here, next to the studios, scored the lowest on that bid. The one, Jacobs Engineering, which had a very impressive, in my opinion, a very impressive proposal for the site down there, scored the highest. But the conversation now goes to which area do we go? Which site do we pursue? And as Andre Wallace said, you know, this is a conversation that Jim Bailey is going to have now with the administration. And it looks like it's going to be basically up to Mayor Curry where they want to do this. I know, and David's been covering this as well. It's very confusing as to where it goes next. I can't call it personally.
Okay, 549-2937 for your calls. We got somebody on hold. Bill from downtown. Bill bought a building but got no incentives. Bill, tell us your story in First Coast Connect.
Yeah, I bought a building downtown, and it's not big, but it's been around a long time, but I didn't get a subsidy. And if I kind of suspect if I wrote him a letter, like a moratorium on my taxes for the years that I've been empty, which have been will be two in December, I'm sure I get a letter back. Sorry.
Which building did you buy?
I can't tell you that, but okay. I did buy it under a corporate name. But nonetheless, I don't think anybody... Everybody wants something free, but I think you have to do the analysis and say, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? For me, it will work ultimately getting the right tenants involved, the right tenant mix. But I think it's a market force. It's a market idea. It's an idea of a market. And I don't think you need a lot of help. I think if you have the cash, if you have the finance, you go do it. If it doesn't make sense, you don't do it.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bill. Appreciate your call. So let's talk about that. I mean, it's an uneven playing field. I mean, we hear about Shad Khan. We hear about Peter Rummel. They seem to have a leg up in getting city incentives. Dave Barreline, what do you notice? I mean, you've been covering this a long time.
Well, in terms of the Berkman II, that's a property that sat idle for 11 years. So the private market, if there was a market to do it without tax incentives, would have done it a long time ago. It's going to take some level of tax incentives. The whole proposal is half-baked. For those of us who sat through the presentation, there were a lot of unanswered questions. $36 million is a lot of money. It seems like there would be a lot more information detailed before that kind of money gets handed out. But the city has obviously made a commitment to develop downtown. That's going to require incentives and public-private partnerships.
Yeah, and we've got another piece of DIA news, Downtown Investment Authority news here in First Coast Connect, 549-2937 for your calls. Brian Hughes, Mayor Curry's former campaign manager, current chief of staff. Now he's the CEO, interim basis of DIA. I hope you've heard about this. Mayor Curry's right-hand man's in a position to push for approval of various big-ticket projects, the new convention center, the Berkman Project, whatever happens to the sports complex. We've got some sound here where Mayor Curry talks about his pick.
We need a strong interim in while they do a national search, and so we can keep kicking ass on downtown.
Ooh, and the seven-second delay, I hope that kicked in there.
No, it didn't.
So, you know, Curry's predecessor's in office. I asked him all about it. Tommy Azuri said it was fine, that it was an interim. Alvin Brown says the DIA board knows the policy, so I'll leave it up to them as an independent body. John Payton, John Delaney, they said it was fine on an interim basis. Claire Goforth, let's start with you. Talking about Brian Hughes here, is there a conflict of interest with, you know, Hughes coming in and basically going from chief of staff to this position?
I mean, isn't he still chief of staff? I mean,
yes,
I believe he's doing both jobs.
Double duty.
Very interesting anomaly there. Can he do both? Can he do the head DIA in his spare time? I mean, as they're kind of saying he's going to be doing, I think that's a sort of surprise to Andre Wallace, who was the head of that organization for 3 years. But the fact of the matter is, Brian Hughes comes with a lot of baggage, right? I mean, he's had a very contentious relationship with the press when he was running Curry's campaign. He's been a bit of a liability in City Hall.
I mean,
look at the controversy with Brochet's, her aide, I believe, who accused him of being very aggressive with her. He was later vindicated, but you know, you can only threaten so many people before the word gets around that that's your MO. And I mean, I think it's interesting to see how much turnover there has been in the Curry administration. I wasn't covering the Brown administration as thoroughly as I have as editor of Folio Weekly with Curry, but it does feel like there have been a lot of top level people who have come and gone in the 3 years that he's been mayor.
Okay, I want to get our City Hall guys here, and Dave Barreline, Dave Cotton. What do you notice about the Brian Hughes era, Dave Barreline? You've seen all of it. You were here during the campaign and everything else.
Yeah, that's a good point. Brian Hughes was a big part of the campaign. He helped run the campaign. And I think one of the things to watch is that some of the people who are going to be seeking, let's put it this way, Brian Hughes will be the interim CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority when the Downtown Investment Authority is negotiating with Shad Khan to be the master developer of the shipyards. Shad Khan has been one of the biggest donors to Mayor Curry's political committee, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So that to me is an issue. I'm not sure to what extent Brian Hughes is still involved with the political operation, but there you have that potentially is a conflict of interest there. And then as far as the having somebody who is a staff member in the mayor's office as the interim CEO, the idea behind the DIA was to be an independent, autonomous board. Now, in reality, there's a lot of conversation that takes place already between the DIA staff and the mayor's office before things ever come out. But there's, again, this perception, how autonomous is the Downtown Investment Authority going to be? Or is it just basically a sub-department of the mayor's office?
Well, and we saw that sort of this happen with Kids Hope Alliance, right? Mike Weinstein was sort of named the interim CEO while they searched for a permanent CEO in Joe Peppers. And just to bounce off of what David just said, you know, the DIA meets with the mayor's administration, what, biweekly officially, and then there's probably other meetings there. And one of the points that Jim Bailey, who's the chair of the DIA board, said was, you know, Brian Hughes has been in those meetings since he arrived at City Hall in his official capacity, and that, what was the quote, that he knows more about these deals than anybody else in the city. And I think there was a couple of members on the DIA board that questioned that a little bit, saying that he had never met Brian. They don't, not really familiar with his skill set. I think on an interim basis, it will be interesting to see how these major deals that are also not only just passing through DIA, but these have to go through council. And it's going to require not only Brian Hughes to you know, wrangle these through council. It's going to take some of those other staff members that work in the mayor's office, the liaisons who work with council, to get some of these things moved. The one thing about Andre Wallace, I think, that's undeniable is he knows his stuff. He has got a very good working relationship with most people on council, and I think people trust his opinion on these things. Andre endorsed Brian at this meeting. Jim Bailey, the chair, asked the board to trust him with this. So it will be very interesting in the next couple of months to see how this all maneuvers. And who knows how long they're going to actually take to get another CEO. They said it could be 6 months, I think.
Yeah, that would take us through the election.
Yeah.
You know, Fred, when you look at the electoral landscape here, we don't know who might be running for mayor against Lenny Curry, but, you know, putting his campaign guy in charge of downtown, what kind of optics does that send to voters?
Well, it sends a very clear optics. I mean, this is my guy. This is my project, and I'm in charge. Look, everybody who's ever sent a proposal in through the DIA and the old its predecessor knows and knew then that you had to also, especially if it's raises to this level, you had to also get the blessing from the mayor's office if it was going to get on the agenda. That's the first thing. And the second thing, you're going to have to make sure that all of those areas are covered. So this is not unusual. I don't think anybody should be terribly surprised or shocked about this because Brian Hughes can, you know, he has the ear of the mayor. He runs the show. So if you're going to get something, whatever's going to come up, you can be assured that the mayor's office has checked off on it at this point. And it's just a question of whether or not the board is going to vote. After all, the DIA here is all part of the executive level of our government before it gets to the city council. So the city council is just going to be basically either guessing or knowing it by the time it gets to them. It's really going to be a fait accompli once they have put all the pieces together and the mayor has his blessing, because we can assume that once it leaves the DIA and goes to the council, it's got the blessing of everybody involved.
Okay, yeah. And we got Mike Weinstein, too, the CFO of the city, moving out. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the decision that's happening. And, you know, so we're seeing a lot of transition. Claire, you mentioned the revolving door in and out of City Hall. Mike Weinstein's gone. What does that mean for the city?
You know, I'm not really sure what his specific exit means for the city, but it, other than the fact that we're losing someone who has a lot of institutional knowledge, a lot of respect in the community. I mean, everyone that I've ever heard speak of Mike Weinstein says that he's a brilliant man. He's 69 years old, though. Let's be real. He's a retirement age. It's not like this is sort of, oh, my goodness, this 45-year-old is retiring. No, I mean, he has earned his right to, you know, do whatever is on the horizon for him. Maybe he has plans in mind. I do wonder about putting somebody in a position at DIA, back to that, that really requires building bridges, who's known for burning them. You know, I mean, that's kind of what struck me about it. Although, obviously, he has the mayor's ear, Brian Hughes does. Obviously, Lenny Curry has a lot of respect and faith in him, and that does make sense for them to have a good relationship, whoever is in that role. I just wonder how that's going to sit with people who are used to the sort of Southern charm offensive, I mean, if you will.
Well, this is one of those issues. Again, when we talk about the consolidated government, we go back to that. This is one of those issues that doesn't concern anybody in Mandarin, what they're doing downtown at the DIA, used to be the DDA, is what I was trying to remember. They don't care. about this. And that's the point. Nobody cares about this except for the people who are putting in deals to make money downtown. Other than that, this guy that just called in, he bought a building and nobody gave him any money. Well, he didn't ask the right people.
Didn't have the right lawyer.
Right lawyer. And I mean, that's what makes the difference here. And so nobody's going to care that Brian Hughes gets it. We're the only people who really knows what Brian Hughes, who he is and what he looks like. Nobody else knows who he is and what he looks like.
Well, I think, though, Fred, I mean, I part of the issue, I think, is that right now, the way it's been, effectively, there's two agreements that need to be had in order to get something on the DAA board agenda. The mayor's office has to sort of sign off on it, and the DIA's chief executive officer has to say, I'm ready to bring this to the board, who is hired by the board. Right now, we're going to have the CEO in the interim basis of the Downtown Investment Authority is someone who's hired by the mayor. And yes, he has been selected by the DIA to be the interim, but it takes away a little bit of the checks and balances, in my opinion. Yeah. And I think people in Mandarin should be not concerned or worried about that, but attentive to that, because that's how things end up getting before city council ultimately that have a lot of impact on taxpayers.
I will say with these particular projects that we've talked about, the convention center and the Berkman, I think these conversations are going to be very difficult at the city council level. We saw that with the district where not everybody bought into the district. I mean, it passed ultimately, but I think there's going to be a lot of hard questions on both of those projects moving forward.
We're going to keep tabs on all of this, of course, as we go forward. Let's move on to a little bit of state news. We got Donald Trump versus Ron DeSantis. Did you hear about this? Trump has been privately criticizing a GOP gubernatorial nominee, Ron DeSantis, accusing him of disloyalty because they broke on the death toll in Puerto Rico. Trump does not think that approximately 3,000 people died. He tweeted that, you know, death toll was inflated. And Ron DeSantis said, well, the estimates are basically what they are. So when we look at it now, people familiar with the president's thinking, according to Politico, are saying that DeSantis is politically indebted to Donald Trump and that DeSantis has been disloyal. So when we look at the Trump-DeSantis dynamic, you know, it's a razor-tight gubernatorial race. Claire, I want to get you in here. What do you think about the Trump-DeSantis dynamic? And, you know, what's bound to happen where Ron DeSantis was going to have to eventually acknowledge reality rather than Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, Ron DeSantis has yoked himself very tightly to President Trump, and you know, that's how he won the primary. That's how he became candidate for governor. But now he's faced with the issue where whatever crazy thing Trump tweets or says or does, he's going to be asked a question about it. Someone's going to shove a microphone in his face and say, hey, do you believe that 3,000 Puerto Ricans died as a result of the hurricane? And he's going to have to answer to that. And when the president is saying things that have been so thoroughly debunked that it just presents, you either have to lie and say, I agree with the president and promote a conspiracy theory, or you have to be honest, as he was, on to his credit, and say, no, I do think that those deaths actually occurred. And maybe that is going to present a problem with every new tweet and every new just shocking press conference that Trump has.
Yeah, Fred, I want to get you in here. I mean, looking at this governor's race, you got Donald Trump, who has basically been a shadow over the whole thing. He endorsed heavily DeSantis in the primary over Adam Putnam. Now he's got a race against Andrew Gillum, a Democrat, who did very well here in Duval County. Gillum got over 50% in the primary. Can Gillum win this thing? And if so, how?
Well, I think that on point here, Gillum certainly can win this thing. It's still razor tight. But he has got the progressive movement going. He has got that going. He's got younger voters who are paying attention, apparently, to this race. And he's got a ground game, which is something that the Democrats have statewide. They've played at it and have some pretty good things going on. The local party, to their credit, has been out there going door to door. They've been knocking on my door, for one thing. But they've been going door to door. But that's an actual ground game going on statewide here. And there's some energy that the Democrats haven't had for quite some time. And by the way, has anybody noticed that Mr. DeSantis is now pronouncing his name DeSantis. It's DeSantis, folks. It's not DeSantis. It's DeSantis. And I think that he has no choice. I want to see if he's going to run those commercials with his kid again, that where he's building the wall and teaching us all about the books. How is that going to play for the general? I want him to carry it out. He can't.
We're getting close to only in Florida here, too. Well, you know, I want to get a quick question in here. I mean, obviously, there's a City Hall connection. Mayor Curry called DeSantis, his brother from a different mother. Mayor Curry has embraced Donald Trump many times. You know, when we look at this pitched partisan battle, and the mayor's race in about 6 months, is it going to hurt Mayor Curry, Dave Barreline? What do you expect? Is Mayor Curry going to be accountable for what the Republicans are saying on a larger level?
I don't think that Donald Trump is going to have an impact in the municipal elections, other than there's going to be a lot of people who are registered to vote who may not otherwise be registered to vote in the spring because they want to vote in November. And there could be a real mobilization that is not necessarily a Lenny Curry voter that's going to be on the rolls that could potentially be there in the spring elections.
Do people in 2019 remember this stuff when they're voting for mayor, Dave Cotton?
I think the people who are galvanized on the left certainly will. I think the Republicans who are just going to back Curry no matter what will. I think at the end of the day, Trump, Florida is very important to Trump. We've got the White House part two down in Mar-a-Lago, and at the end of the day, he wants a Republican in the governor's mansion, so he may be fuming behind the scenes, but there's going to be a rally. DeSantis, they're going to be chummy. I don't see this big break between them like I think is being reported this week.
Yeah, and there actually is a fundraiser. Lenny Curry is going to be part of the host committee for Ron DeSantis next week. It's here in town. They're trying to, you know, fill that fundraising gap because Gillum's ahead in the fundraising. So, you know, we're going to keep tabs on all of that. It's time just about to move to our Only in Florida segment. There's our new music. Let us know what you think, 549-2937. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, there's never a shortage of material, and it's washing up on the shores. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Only in Florida do bundles of marijuana wash up on shore. They call them a square grouper out there. It happened as Hurricane Florence was approaching the East Coast. About 100 pounds of the wacky weed washed ashore in St. John's, Flagler, and Volusia counties. A little advice, if you see bricks of pot coming ashore, do the right thing and call the police.
I didn't see anything, is the general response from everybody in this county.
Nothing to see here.
Seaweed, yes. Yeah. Beach blanket bongo. A man named Robert Kelly was seen opening up the packages that came ashore in Flagler County. Police, they searched his vehicle. God knows how they found out it was there. They found a brick of marijuana. What's a brick of marijuana, Fred? And charged him with felony possession of over 20 grams of marijuana. So obviously, this is something we've seen across the state. We're going to continue to see it across the state. Claire Goforth, what do you think about all this?
The discoverer has the right to keep it. Yes, in law, you found it. It's found property. There you go.
See
go get your marijuana cards, everyone.
That's your law school degree coming into play there. I want to thank our panel, Dave Barreline, Fred Matthews, David Cotton, Claire Goforth. Thanks for carrying me through today's show. We're going to have a segment on at 9:50, so thank you so much.
All right.
Have a great day.
Thank you, JP.
And I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, hoping you will give us a call now because WJCT listeners are the best. Your continued support of WJCT is what keeps the programs you count on the air. Well, it's that time of the year again. We are here to ask you for your financial support, and we want to do it without those prolonged program interruptions called Pledge. Our goal is $60,000 before September 28th. That's next Friday, so you need to call us right now. Donate today. We're now at $16,000. We've got a ways to go. So visit us at wjct.org/radio or call us at 353-9528. And you can help us minimize the number of days we fundraise on air. We're at $16,000, as I said. We've got a ways to go. We've got to get to $60,000. I brought in a check this morning. Won't you call us now with your financial donation? 353-9528 or go online now at wjct.org.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan.
A company's cell phone policy can protect your employees and your bottom line. Our distracted driving presentation for the workforce can help.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
The Jacksonville Humane Society presents Toast to the Animals, Saturday, September 22nd at TIAA Bank Field, benefiting the Pet Medical Fund, serving homeless dogs and cats needing veterinary care and TLC, hors d'oeuvres, wine, and beer. Tickets at jackshumane.org.
Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center in Jacksonville, Florida. Nurse navigators, targeted therapies, and doctors from every specialty, all on one team, yours. Online at baptistmdanderson.com.
This is it. We only have a few days left to reach our $60,000 goal for the WJCT Fall Pledge Drive. We're committed to reaching our goal as quickly and as interruption-free as possible. So give now at wjct.org/radio.
As the controversy around Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh roils Washington, Republican Senator Susan Collins faces intense pressure at home in Maine. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Why Senator Collins' future could depend on her vote for or against Kavanaugh. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Typhoons, tariffs, and talks to avoid a messy divorce. The international headlines have been dramatic. Syria accidentally shoots down a Russian plane, China hits back as the trade war escalates, and smiles are hard to come by at a key summit in Salzburg. We'll wrap up what's been going on around the world on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Finally, Sarah, we're going to quilting. Get your fabric on because it's time for the annual Quilt Fest going on this weekend at the Prime Osborne Center. For 32 years, quilters from around Northeast Florida and beyond have gotten together to show off their creations. The mother of Quilt Fest is 94-year-old Frances Case, and she joins us now. Good morning, Frances. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
I cannot believe you're 94.
I'm not. I'm 96.
Oh, wow. So, you know, quilting obviously doesn't age you. How'd you get into it?
Well, I grew up in that renaissance of quilting in the back in the 30s and the 20s. So I learned quilting at my mother and my aunt's knees. And when we moved to Florida, there was a renaissance of quilting, and I just kind of got involved with it.
So when did you move to Florida?
In 87.
Okay, so you learned quilting, you know, in your youth. And at that point, you know, 20s and 30s, you know, people needed the quilt, didn't they?
We did indeed.
Yeah, I mean, the economy was much different then, and you didn't have store-bought blankets in the same way. So, you know, quilting was an economic necessity, but, you know, what's the symbolic value of a quilt? When you're doing that with your family, you're sitting there, and you're making these quilts out of fabric. What stories come into play?
You're building your family history sometimes. You're also being innovative and quilting for the future. But most of the time, I think you're making something for someone who is beloved to you or beloved to yourself so you can express it in an artistic way.
Yeah, I mean, I've got quilts from my grandmother, and, you know, she passed 20 years ago, and I still value those quilts, and I remember some of the stories about the fabric on them, you know, and it was really, they've really been a way to carry on family traditions. So, you know, that's a big deal. So, you know, when you came here and you got involved in quilting, you know, tell us a little about that process. I mean, how'd you get from, you know, moving here to getting this thing going at the Prime Osmer's been going for decades now? Tell us about it.
Well, when we moved to Florida, we retired to Florida from Wisconsin, and I was free for the first time in my life to do something artistic rather than raising children and making money to survive. And I joined a group of women in St. Augustine who were devoted to fabric and quilting, and from there got involved with Quilt Fest. And it kind of built on that foundation until we have this magnificent show, which is at the Prime Osborne now, that you know, has been going on since 87. And it's just a marvelous artistic endeavor of women's contribution to the art world.
So, you know, tell us about some of the diversity in the quilts that you might see. I mean, you know, you've got a bunch of different quilters, different backgrounds. Like, I imagine the quilts don't all look the same, do they?
Oh, my goodness, no. We're hanging over 300 quilts, and they go from hand-quilted, hand-pieced to the modern technology with Statler quilting machines where everything is computerized. And the fabrics have changed. You know, the fabrics now that you see on the market are much different than they were 30 years ago even.
So, you know, more synthetics, less synthetics?
I don't believe synthetics are as popular as natural cotton. You know, the old-fashioned natural things. The synthetic products are not really inducive to artistic quilting.
Right on. We're on with Frances Case, the mother of Quilt Fest. That's going on, you know, if you're just tuning in. Jacksonville Prime Osborne Center is hosting the Quilt Fest from the 20th, which was yesterday, to the 22nd. This year's theme is Quilters Rule. Why Quilters Rule? Why is that the theme?
Well, we're women, and we quilt with rulers.
Okay.
So why should we rule? But the nice thing is that at Quilt Fest, we're also passing on the tradition of quilting to the youngsters. We have a children's corner where children can come and experience quilting. They can make a little quilt to take home. We have on view over, you know, over 500 quilts. We have 80 vendors.
80 vendors.
Where, you know, they bring their merchandise to the Prime Osborne, and then we go spend our money and go home and put it together into a quilt.
Yeah, and there's also a quilt appraisal at the show, correct? I mean, there's,
yes.
Okay, so is that like Antiques Roadshow, but for quilts?
It isn't the Antique Roadshow, but if you have family quilts, it's good to have them appraised and a certified appraiser to do that for insurance purposes. And particularly if you're in a family situation where you're going to pass them on to the family, you might want to put a monetary value on them. And money, you know, many of the quilts are worth thousands of dollars, so they should be insured and certified. So for insurance purposes,
you know, what determines those top end value quilts? How is a quilt worth thousands of dollars? Tell us about that.
Technique, the maker, the fabric, the artistic. It's like a valuable painting, only it's in fabric.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about Quilt Fest here in First Coast Connect with Frances Case. Show hours today, 9 to 5, Saturday, 9 to 5. Tickets are $10 daily. Military gets in for $9 with valid ID. Children, 10 and under school groups are free. You know, so you've got these incentives for military, for seniors, for children to come out. Obviously, this is for the whole community, correct?
It's for the whole community, and it truly is the only American craft.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Frances Case with Quilt Fest. It's at the Prime Osborne right now on Saturday. Cheap to get in. I encourage you all to go. QuiltFestJax.com for tickets and more information also. And that's our show for today. I want to thank our guests, thank our callers. The show's producers, Kevin Mearshart. Michelle Quorum is running the boards, only she does. The show's theme composed and performed by Peter Shevchik. If you have questions or comments, send an email, firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And this is Reed Broadcasting tonight at 8 p.m. 89.9 will also be streaming. Thank you so much. Have a great week. And
support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.